Welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Well, in today's lecture, what we're going to talk about is absorption of toxicants. This is a good lecture in terms of the continuity of last lecture, where we talked about dose response, the quantitative relationship between toxicants and organisms in terms of the presentation of toxicity. What we're going to do today is talk about that primary threshold, that primary barrier that a chemical is going to interface with biology, one of our comfortable definitions of toxicology, chemistry at the interface of biology. What we're going to do is try to look at all of the membranes that chemicals have to or have the potential to cross in terms of primary toxicosis. Okay. Next time, what we're going to do is talk about storage and distribution. What happens next? Once we've crossed that primary barrier of absorption, what happens within the organisms primary to some sort of presentation of clinical disease? Now, this is a very interesting segment of toxicology because it introduces us or starts introducing us into organismal biology. For those of you that have not had much anatomy or physiology or just have had introductory biology, this is the beginning of the segment of the course where we'll start learning a little bit more about anatomy and physiology as it relates to toxicology. I can't overemphasize this is not an AMP course. What we're trying to do is give the students that don't have much background in this particular area of science or biology enough information, a primer, if you will, on AMP so that you can come move along with the rest of the students that have more or a stronger biology background. Our learning objectives, what we are going to try to have you do is describe the ways in which toxicants interact with cells. How we do that in terms of the organism, think of organisms or our cells as being a somewhat massive collection of differentiated cells. We're a very organized system of biology. Each one of these different interfaces, these membranes that present in terms of this primary interaction of chemistry and biology, can have different behavior, different characteristics. However, fundamental cellular biology, fundamental cellular biochemistry is extraordinarily similar, and so we have similar potential for damage, although what we find is that the presentation of toxicants, just because of the way that we interact with our environment, is different. Now think about it in the past 24 hours, all of the different routes, the potential routes that you might have come across in terms of exposure to potential toxicants. What did you eat? What did you breathe? What did you drink? Okay. What did you bathe in? Did you go swimming in a natural water body that may have had some degree of low-level pollution in it? All of these things are potential absorption impacts in terms of the primary level of toxicosis. Now we're going to try also to recognize how molecular characteristics affect entrance into a cell. This is actually mostly through your reading. We've introduced this concept in terms of things like log KOW, the octanol water partition coefficient, these empirical sort of coefficients that allow us to look at how a cell membrane and a chemical might interact. These are some of the things that we've done previously in lectures, and we will also do in readings. We'll try to introduce and explain some human anatomy as it is related to the integumentary, which is our skin, respiratory, and digestive systems. These are the three primary pathways of toxicosis. We'll try as well, within the context of this lecture, summarize the routes of toxin absorption so that you have some idea of the efficiencies, the rapidness. And this will have to do with the level of exposure that might come across this particular pathway, this route of absorption, but also things like the physical and chemical characteristics of the membrane, and as well, very importantly, blood flow to that area. You know, for example, our pulmonary system has high blood flow because we have to have incredible exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide. That pulmonary blood flow also allows for toxicants once respired in terms of inhalation to actually access and be systemically distributed around the body in very rapid fashion because of the high pulmonary blood flow. Well, in terms of organization of the body, one of the things that we'd like to do to introduce our primer on anatomy and physiology is take a look at our physical characteristics and how they relate to the chemical level of toxicants. In terms of our Statue of David here, This is obviously the organism level, and we have the organ system level. And so you can, for example, develop a system level toxicosis. Organ level toxicosis, we will do an entire lecture series on target organ toxicity. In terms of the interaction on a chemical to tissue basis, we can have interaction or disruption, for example, necrotic tissue developing in an area of toxicosis. We're showing in this particular case the nephrons of the kidney here in the tissue level. But fundamentally, what we have is cellular level biology interacting with chemicals. And this is the primary interaction level, and it's the interaction level that we will be focusing on in a discussion of absorption of toxicants. Now, we need to understand a little bit about how cells organize themselves, what they do, if you want to look at it in a very, very simplistic way. Cells do biosynthesis, and they also do catabolism. They build things up, and they break things down. They do this with energy from ATP, but they also use enzymes to help carry out these programmatic processes, biochemical processes of cells. In terms of the biosynthesis, the metabolism part of cells, typically what happens is we have an organization of monomers being developed into larger molecules, biomolecules referred to as polymers. So these subunit chemicals are organized as macromolecules. And so you can think of these as the sugars, the saccharides being developed into polysaccharides, glucose into glycogen, or for example, amino acids being synthesized by cellular processes into proteins, a very important part of the impacts or potential impacts of toxicosis. Nucleotides will be organized into DNA and RNA and cellular replication processes. One of the things that we want to do here when we talk about chemicals interacting with biology is make sure that we understand, have a good representation for what chemicals are. Now, in freshman chemistry and organic chemistry, you were introduced to many different representations of chemicals. So you have Lewis diagrams and stick and bar diagrams, sometimes stick and ball diagrams, and sometimes things like what is on this particular slide, adenylic acid, which is an electron distribution diagram. It gives you a sense of the 3D representation of what a chemical is. And I want you, in the context of the module online for this particular lecture, and also for the course, to have a good representation that a good understanding that the two-dimensional representations of chemicals, these flat diagrams, are actually representations of three-dimensional units. And these chemicals actually have within them electron densities. They have shape. They have charge. They have the ability sometimes to interact directly or indirectly with various receptors in terms of the ability of a toxicant to actually become a false key, for instance, in a hormonal interaction. But I want you to go online to the protein data bank and actually get some of the software downloaded so that you can have an experience of traveling inside of a three-dimensional molecule. Now, in terms of the composition of bacteria, if we enumerate the percent of the total weight, and this example is for an E. coli bacterium, 70% water. We have one molecule that makes up water. But in terms of proteins, it's about 15% of the weight, but great diversity in proteins, about 3,000 total. This is a significant number in terms of diversity, and it should clue you in that, in fact, these proteins are an important part of cellular physiology and what makes bacteria or these cellular organisms actually work. Nucleic acids, DNA, obviously we just have one molecule of that. RNA, maybe six. Those RNA molecules are the key pathway in terms of the biosynthesis of proteins. The types of molecules, 6% of the weight, those molecules, because they code for protein manufacture, greater than 3,000 subunits of RNA. Polysaccharides, about 3%, types of molecules, about five different ones, about 20 different lipids. Building block molecules of various types and inorganic ions make up the bulk of the rest. The take-home message of this slide is that protein and protein biosynthesis is an important part of what cells do from a diversity point of view. And so there's a lot of potential for interruption of key enzyme systems, for example, enzymes or proteins, key receptors, key processes, whether it be structural proteins in terms of the potential for birth defects. And so these are key arenas of toxicosis because of the sheer diversity in numbers. One of the other things that I want to go back and have you review is just fundamental or basic cell structure here. I've highlighted on this cartoon out of a biology textbook the nucleus, the mitochondrion, the cytoplasm, the ribosomes, the cell membranes. All of these are key targets of interaction for various toxicological processes. Remember that we're dealing with a chemical that is going to interact with the chemicals that make up these particular systems or subsystems of cellular structure. Okay, so for example, and I'll show you an example here in a second in terms of a picture, think about what might happen with a reactive chemical with the lipid membrane and how that might interact or react. What happens when, for example, cellular membranes are broken and allow for all of the internal components of that cell to exit the cell, to leak out? What happens when we have a disruption of various cellular triggering or receptor processes? All of these have a very, very important part in terms of the interplay of chemicals and potential for toxicosis. One of the things also that we need to respect and review is the replication, transcription, and translation processes of the cell. Replication happens in terms of DNA, in terms of cellular division. This is a nuclear process. Outside, external of the nucleus, we have transcription processes where RNA leaves the nucleus and interacts with the ribosomes for translations in terms of the primary steps of protein synthesis that happen out in the cytoplasm. And so we can have defects that happen in the nucleus in terms of chemicals that can cross the nuclear membrane, and we can have ribosomal attack, for example, chemicals that might attack ribosomes and interact directly with translation. Now think of all of the dozens, hundreds, and in some cases thousands or tens of thousands of different chemicals, amino acids or nucleotides that make up all of the sequences of all of the biochemical components here. There is great opportunity, if you will, for interruption, disruption from toxicosis. Direct interaction in terms of just chemicals that react with other chemicals. But for example, what happens if you've got an amino acid that is in fact a false amino acid in a chain? We do have many systems in terms of cellular biology to repair and replace defective copies of RNA, even cellular processes in terms of DNA repair. So we do have the ability to heal ourselves, and there is also the ability of our immune system and other systems to interact with broken cells that seem to be misbehaving, and we do have, in fact, the ability on a cellular basis to destroy those cells that have been damaged from a genetic point of view. Now, I introduced that proteins, this tremendous diversity of biochemical products in a cell, is also a very ripe point of potential toxicosis. Proteins are synthesized primarily during this process of translation at the nucleotide. The building blocks of these proteins are amino acids. They are just chemicals themselves, and so you can have direct interactions because we have some reactive chemical, a toxicant, in there. And again, they can run the full range of amino acid-like compounds, for example, or just chemicals that have high degree of reactivity with the electrophilic sites or the nucleophilic sites on amino acids. These proteins are made of long chains of amino acids. In terms of introductory biology, they're peptide bonds and disulfide bonds, for example, on cysteine molecule, a sulfur-bearing amino acid. This gives us a little bit of primary structure and also secondary and somewhat tertiary structure. All of these are potential disruptions in terms of these three-dimensional, and this is a really important concept to take home, these three-dimensional reactive sites involved with some of these proteins. Now, proteins can be modified by heme groups, sugar groups, and various phosphates in terms of their particular function and what they do. I've given you an idea here in terms of reviewing a little bit of biochemistry, that amino acids are just chemical compounds, alanine, aspartate, cysteine, phenylalanine, give you an idea. Chemicals can react with chemicals. Toxicants are chemicals, and so these are points of potential reactivity. And so go back to fundamental amino acid chemistry in terms of the spontaneous reaction of amino acids with other amino acids to form dipeptides, remembering that these amine groups, for instance, are fairly reactive. Well, what happens if we have other sorts of chemically reactive nitrogen compounds like nitrite, forming potential nitrosamines, for example, known carcinogens? And so these are, the point here is just to take home that in toxicology we are dealing fundamentally with a cascading effect of chemicals reacting with biochemicals of some variety. In terms of how we start forming structures, remember that these amino acid chains, I did an experiment, I happen to have some software that will give lowest energy conformations. And so I started to, in this particular software, just adding amino acids randomly in terms of these peptide bonds. In about 10 or 20 minutes, I made this pretty nice amino acid chain here. But you notice that it starts forming at least a little bit of secondary structure here, some primary coiling around. If we space fill that instead of just looking at sticks, sticks and balls, and fill it out, you can see that you can start developing this alpha helix. If I reduce this down to what's referred to as a ribbon diagram, we can see this alpha helix secondary structure. These can also pleat over on themselves, especially if we have sulfur residues at forming disulfide bonds. These alpha, or the secondary structures, and also the tertiary structures are important parts of this dimensionality that we have in proteins. And remember back, we showed a picture of hemoglobin. We'll do that again here in a moment. But I asked you to go onto the protein structure data bank and actually turn and twist that around to get an idea of what the active site is on hemoglobin and what the other structural support mechanism is. In terms of what the reactive or potential toxicant activity might be. This was the example from the protein data bank of hemoglobin protein structure. If you start representing the proteins as these alpha helices, you can see that the heme groups are actually tucked inside of here. There's reactive groups, there's other structural support, and we find this quite often in various enzymes, receptors, cholinesterase. We'll deal with in a very similar way as a point of potential toxicosis, a fairly large complex molecule with active sites that can be acted on by these relatively small molecules that inhibit cholinesterase. They react irreversibly or somewhat irreversibly with cholinesterase. Now, in terms of cataloging the protein functions that might be disrupted during toxicosis, we have to understand the full array of potential functions we have for proteins. They can act as antibodies where they recognize molecules of invading organisms, and this is a chemical reactivity, typically one that's mediated by larger or macromolecules. But sometimes smaller molecules can actually react with other biochemicals to form haptens, and these haptens then will have a antibody reaction. Proteins can form receptors, which is can be a part of the cell membrane. It can recognize other proteins or chemicals, and there can be some chemotaxis, or a chemical information chain, a chemical telegraph, if you will, chain of reactions that initiate some sort of cellular process. Proteins can function as enzymes where they can assemble or digest different components or chemicals in biosynthesis or in catabolic processes. Proteins can function as neurotransmitters, as hormones that can trigger various receptors and the cascade of potential responses from receptor-hormone interaction, for example. There can be structural attributes of proteins where they form channels or pores. Sometimes the channels and pores are on the cellular basis in terms of allowing transport of various chemicals such as calcium into the cell. Sometimes these can be structural in terms of just the macrostructures that we have in our bodies. In terms of cellular absorption, we can find several different processes that happen in terms of a chemical and a membrane. And these membranes are the membranes of cellular membranes and tissues made up of groups of cells. You can recall from freshman chemistry that diffusion is a concentration gradient directed process by thermodynamics. If you recall Fick's law, high concentrations will migrate to lower concentrations. And so typically in an intoxication, we have a higher concentration on one side of the membrane, and we will have diffusion via the concentration gradient towards the other side of the membrane. We can have facilitated diffusion because there are certain processes to facilitate transport across membranes. These are membrane surface carrier proteins. And so, for example, you can get active transport of lead, which it has a charge similar to calcium across membrane via calcium transport proteins. Glucose transport is another key metabolic facilitated diffusion cycle associated with toxicosis. We can have active transport that does require some sort of energy. It's an upgradient transport, for example. We can have endo or exocytosis. Endocytosis is kind of a swallowing, if you will. An exo is a release of material on a molecular basis, typically. So with exo, it's spitting it out. With endo, it's taking it in across a membrane. These can also be referred to as phago or pinocytosis. Phagocytosis is an engulfing. A pino is and it's an engulfing, and it actually creates a membrane-lined vacuole, if you will, within the cell. Or a pinocytosis, where it actually expels a membrane-encircled waste product. Endocytosis is another form of phagocytosis. I promised you a cell membrane diagram, and I give it to you here. And again, this goes back to just identifying that, in fact, cell membranes are made up of chemicals, and we're talking about the ability of chemicals as toxicants to interact with chemicals as biochemicals, making up some sort of level of biology. In terms of absorption, we need to be concerned primarily about membrane interactivity because at some point in time, to have an impact on the organism, the chemical is going to have to cross a membrane. Membranes are made up of these fatty acids. The membrane itself is largely hydrophobic. It allows for the interchains to be kind of linked in this lipid bilayer. We have the ability to have pores that are developed to transport from these integral membrane proteins from the outside of the cell wall to the inside. We have intercellular proteins. We have extracellular proteins. We have proteins that are in the membrane itself that allow for example, receptor interactions and potential chemotaxis within the cell itself. There are four types of cells that we need to be concerned with in terms of physiology. They are epithelial, and these are the coverings, the linings, and the secretions. This is the primary tissue that we're concerned about in absorption of toxicants. Connective cells gives us support and energy. For example, many of the support tissues and the keratinized tissues, and as well our vascular system is referred to as a connective tissue. We have muscle tissues that give us movement, and we have nervous tissues that give us that have electrical impulses. They give us information. They transport sensation from one part of the body to the other, as well as our central nervous system. In terms of the interactions, obviously all types of cells can interact with toxicants in terms of the potential for damage. In terms of absorption, we have to be most worried about epithelial cells. In terms of target organ toxicity, we'll talk at length about neurotoxicity and the direct interaction of neurotoxins and the nervous system. It's not a bad idea to understand the dimensionality of epithelial cells. We can classify those as squamous cells, cuboidal and columnar, and these are just morphological classifications. They can be identified as simple, in terms of simple squamous, simple cuboidal, and simple columnar cells. And we can also have stratified layers of these squamous cells as well. These cells with their membranes make up these outer linings that we need to be most concerned about in absorptions of toxicants. The other category I'll talk about, and I won't introduce all the different bone tissues in terms of connective and support tissues. There are some diagrams in the readings for that. We are interested, however, in nerve cells because of the communication between nerve cells and the potential for neurotoxicity. Not necessarily absorption, but it is something that, from an anatomy physiology basis, there is on the website an animation of neurotoxicity that identifies, at least from a cartoon point of view, something that we've put together to show you an introductory level of the phenomenological illustration of neurotoxicity from cholinesterase inhibition. Well, in terms of, again, continuing our introductory anatomy and physiology, we have 11 organ systems, the integumentary system, something we'll talk about at length because the integumentary, or our skin, is the largest organ in the body. Our skeletal organ system, muscular system, nervous system, the endocrine system, which is a target for endocrine disruption, our cardiovascular system and lymphatic system, moving much slower into drainage system for the body, our digestive system, the respiratory system, and then our urinary system, which allows for excretion of toxicants, and as well the reproductive system, which is gender specific. Now, absorption is best defined as the process by which toxicants cross the epithelial cell barrier. Okay, so there's the take home for this particular lecture. And in terms of the routes of absorption, we have three primary routes, the integumentary or percutaneous. So this is a dermal transport that goes through the outer skin layer. We can have respiratory absorption, and so we can think of all of the different pathways involved in respiration. Then we'll talk about in detail these as well. And then the digestive route of absorption. I put a picture here of obviously a laboratory scientist that is quite worried about all three routes. I could identify that his or her mouth is covered, any sort of membranes are covered, hands are covered, and the idea in terms of limiting the potential exposure with either a pathogen or toxicant in this particular case, this individual is covering all of the potential routes of absorption, integumentary, respiratory, and digestive. Well, let's go through these three routes. The integumentary system route. The system is made up of skin and hair, nails, and the mammary glands. And yes, boys, we do have mammary glands, just in case you haven't checked that out. Skin is the largest organ in the body. It is consisting of the epidermis, the dermis, and the hypodermis. In the epidermis, we have avascular keratinized stratum corneum. This is the thick, somewhat dead cell, 15 to 20 cells thick, that's on the outside of it. It provides most toxicant protection. People that work with chemicals, you will find them using a lot of hand lotion to keep their skin very healthy, because breaks in your skin allow for rapid transport of toxicants. Dermis is the next layer down. This is highly vascularized. This is where we start finding nerve endings, hair follicles, and sweat and oil glands. Those sweat and oil glands are also have the ability of toxicant transport. We have hypodermis, which is connective and adipose tissue, that is in the next layer down. We can take a look at this with this cartoon, which simplifies generic skin. And you can see the stratum corneum up here, a layer of keratinized, often dead cells, followed by the epidermis, the dermis, and then you get into the adipose tissue. You see the vascularization here in terms of the arterial and the venous systems, the capillaries that provide nutrients, flow, and the transport of waste materials, cellular waste materials out of this. That transport also allows for any toxicants that have crossed the membrane barrier in terms of the epithelial skin integumentary barrier to actually be transported to other parts of the body. If, for example, we have a chemical that is highly transportable in terms of transdermal toxicity, there will be the potential for it to actually enter the blood system via the capillaries in our skin. This is a short case study, and what I'm trying to do here within the context of this lecture is talk about a couple of examples. You can probably think of many yourself in terms of potential toxicosis or incidents that you've had in your own history in terms of, I don't know, perhaps brushing up with a toxic plant, an insect bite, some sort of toxic reaction or allergic reaction that happens in a very visible area in terms of something you can see on your skin. This particular case is about a Kenyan beetle toxin. This is describing this unfortunate young man with a lesion down the side of his face. He found this colorful bombardier beetle, and this particular species of genal of beetles, it's related to the species Brachnius, actually has a mixing chamber in its body, and its particular defensive array is involved with a mixture of chemicals. These are quinone-based chemicals. The mixing chambers combine two very reactive chemicals, biochemicals, in the animal. It develops a very, very high temperature, and this hot caustic poison comes streaming out of the beetle as a protective envenomation, and it's directed at threats. This boy, I'm sure, saw this colorful beetle and thought it was quite interesting, and found out that this is not a beetle that you play with. Respiratory system route is our next route of absorption. In terms of the types of material, it's a little bit different than our skin. The skin is stratified or layered squamous epithelial tissue, whereas the respiratory system is squamous epithelium, ciliated columnar, and cuboidal epithelium. The ciliated columnar cells are very interesting. Many of you that have ever worked in a dusty environment, perhaps sawdust or cleaning an old attic without any sort of respiratory protection, know that perhaps for a day afterwards you're coughing up sputum that might be quite colorful, gray or black in some cases, if it depends upon how dusty the environment was. If you've worked in agricultural fields out in dusty fields, you've seen this as well. These cells are non-keratinized, so they don't have that kind of hard outer, almost callus-like tissue our skin can develop. We have essentially a tremendous amount of turnover of these cells as well in the gut. These ciliary tissues are quite interesting in that they provide a very peristalsis sort of motion. And it allows to trap particulates. It allows to take fluids and actually escalate them up so that we cough out some of the materials that we have inhaled. The respiratory system route is made up of three primary sections: the nasopharyngeal, the tracheal bronchial, and the pulmonary system, which is the lung interacting with the blood system. This cartoon gives you at least an illustration. So we have the nasopharynx here in terms of our respiratory tracts, the nasal cavity and the oral cavity. That comes down into the trachea. It goes into the primary bronchus, bronchial chambers, into the lung itself. There's a distribution network of bronchi and bronchioles. These bronchus are essentially major pathways, major highways. The bronchioles are the minor sort of side roads. These bronchioles distribute air pathway into the very, very high surface area alveolus. These tissues are highly vascularized to allow for these the exchange of waste materials from respiration, primarily carbon dioxide, but it also could be an elimination product of a volatile metabolic product. For example, it allows also for the inhaled oxygen to be transported into the oxygenated blood supply and distributed from the heart. The pulmonary system has a high rate of blood flow. The various alveolus have extremely high surface area. If I haven't said it yet in the course, the numbers of square meters is about the same as half of a volleyball court. This is a very, very high surface area membrane. It allows for very rapid transport of oxygen across this membrane in terms of our respiratory metabolism. In the nasopharyngeal system route, we have the nostrils, the nasopharynx, the oropharynx, and the laryngopharynx. We have hairs and mucus in this system that are enabled to trap greater than 5 micron particulates. Many of you have seen air warnings. In fact, right now with a number of forest fires, not only are we worried about the smoke, but also particulates that might be in airborne from combustion processes. You'll sometimes hear the term PM10. This is particles that have a 10 micron or less diameter. These are the ones that give us most concern in terms of respiratory toxicity, because you start to get to that threshold where these will go to the furthest reaches of lung tissue and have very limited ability to come back up the mucociliary escalator. In the tracheobronchial region, it's made up of the trachea, the bronchi, the bronchioles, again, these major highways going to minor highways, finally to country roads as it goes kind of inner the smaller interstitial spaces. We have a cilial action on these particular tissues. The mucus, the luminal mucus, which is lining this piece of anatomy, can trap 2 to 5 micron particulates and water-soluble aerosols and gases. In terms of respiratory toxicology, if you breathe a water-reactive toxicant, there can be site interactions. So, for example, acids or bases that have been volatilized are very reactive with water, and so you can actually have tremendous amount of caustic damage, contact surface damage, on these tissues. For example, other chemicals, and we'll talk about Bhopal plasticizers that came out in an occupational industrial accident, interacted with water, causing tremendous amount of damage to this particular structure. And in terms of the pulmonary exchange, this happens at the alveoli. These have extremely high surface area, so high amounts of gas exchange. And that's why, for example, if you do breathe something, for example, sulfide type gases like hydrogen sulfide, you typically have a gag, a very fast gag reflex where you stop breathing. This is probably an involuntary reaction, kind of a brainstem reaction that has come with us through our evolutionary development. But what happens quite often is we find ourselves being exposed to things that we can't smell, we can't sense. This is why, for example, that they put methyl mercaptans, or very smelly sulfur compounds, in the natural gas in your houses if you have a gas stove. The idea is to make you have the ability to sense the gas, which you cannot. Methane doesn't have a particularly strong smell. And there are many airborne toxicants that don't have that sensory sort of warning that, for example, sulfide compounds do. The pulmonary system does allow for this exchange, and in fact, as you will learn, this is also important for metabolites that are volatile. And I use the example that many selenium-based toxicants are actually very much like the sulfur compounds in that they smell. They give you kind of a garlic breath. And there are many metabolic processes that will give us off breath as well Ketosis is one of them. If you've got metabolic ketosis, you will have a very metallic smelling breath because of the byproducts of that particular metabolic problem. This is a lung dissection. This is a bovine lung. This is something I did one afternoon, one summer's afternoon. This is from an abattoir slaughterhouse, and I recovered this particular lobe of a cow lung. And this was a fairly painstaking process, painstaking primarily because of the bronchus and bronchioles, this dissection in here. This is a very hard material. This takes some very sharp scissors to dissect. It doesn't cut very easily. This is a structural pipe, if you will. Whereas, as you get down into some of these high membrane type tissues, this is somewhat gelatinous based tissue that, when it is full of air, is a very wet, moist tissue. This gives you a closer look at the bronchus bronchial intersections. You can kind of see we've got the major highways, and we've got the routes off the major highways, and then we have the country roads. The various bronchioles that pass again from larger areas, and you can kind of see what this tissue looks like, and you see some of the serrations or the morphological structures in these bronchus bronchial structures. This is, if you've never done this sort of thing, you can actually do this quite easily by finding somebody that perhaps butchers their own animals for meat, and doing a little bit of anatomy physiology in someone else's backyard there. In terms of an example of respiratory toxicosis, in 1984, a tragic incident in Bhopal, India. You can search around on the internet and find out tremendous amounts of information of this particular tragedy. What happened was there was a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India. One of the chemicals involved in this particular manufacturing process, and this was one of the chemicals they produced there, was carbaryl, an insecticide we talked about in lecture 4. It's a carbamate, an N-methyl carbamate insecticide. But one of the starting materials, methyl isocyanate, is also a plasticizer. It's commonly used in many industrial processes, even for particle board manufacturing in terms of wood products, various materials that require plastization. It's a chemical that does react with water. It can polymerize, and so imagine breathing this particular material in. It was an industrial accident, a fairly tragic one, in that it happened at night, and so many people were intoxicated in their sleep. You can read about the social justice and injustice of this particular situation in many documents online. It was a tragedy because of the nefarious mode of action of this particular chemical. Because it is a cyanide-containing compound, it can metabolize cyanide and lead to cyanosis. It can also directly damage, because of its reactivity with water, lung tissues and cells. And so even many of the survivors of this particular incident still have impaired lung capacity. Another case study in terms of an industrial occupational exposure you may have read about in 2002. This hit the news. This was a case of fixed obstructive lung disease, and these were in workers at a microwave popcorn factory. That smell and taste of butter popcorn comes from a particular chemical that they were adding in this microwave popcorn factory. A occupational physician noticed a cluster of fixed obstructive lung disease in workers from this one particular plant. It seemed that people that had worked there the longest had a significant amount of lung damage, impaired respiratory function, and there were a number of individuals with sufficient chronic scarring that they had to actually get lung transplants. And so this was a severe toxicosis. They had all worked at the plant about the same time in the 1990s through 2000. In terms of the epidemiological studies and then the occupational exposure studies, they isolated some of the volatiles that they were using, the chemical compounds that were volatilized during this particular food processing process. They isolated a couple of them, diacetyl, which is 2,3-butanedione, The chemical structure is on here. This is one of the chemicals that gives us that sensory butter flavor, if you will. They did identify, because of all the different processes, about 100 volatile organic compounds in the factory air. This particular chemical does have some tremendous, some level of reactivity. The air concentration was about 18 parts per million, and so you could smell it, and I would say at 18 parts per million, probably taste it. This is, again, typically 18 parts per million will be a milligram per cubic meter in terms of air concentrations. And so they did find this, and in terms of addressing the needs, not only in terms of the impaired health of some of the workers, but also creating a safe work environment, they did do a tremendous amount of re-engineering of the plant to isolate any volatiles from the workplace. Our next route of absorption that we're going to talk about is the digestive system route. The digestive system involves the mouth, the oral cavity, the esophagus, the stomach, the small intestine, the rectum, and the anus. This is important not only for exposure, but also for elimination, and we'll talk about how that happens. The residence time in terms of our gut can determine some amount of the destruction of tissues or potential destruction of tissues because of the residence time at a particular site. We have in our mouth a relatively short amount of time, and if it's very reactive, typically we're going to have some the sensations, the same nerve endings that give us the wonderful flavors and tastes of various chemicals, including, for example, capsaicin. Capsaicin is the hot in red chili peppers. It's a neurotoxin. It's, for many of us, a very flavorful neurotoxin. Have you ever noticed the commercials for capsaicin lotions for people that have arthritis or some sort of pain? So the next time you eat that spicy meal, know that, in fact, capsaicin is can be, in industrial grades, a very, very potent neurotoxin. But quite often, if we have a tremendous amount of potential for tissue damage with a toxicant, we'll have a gag reflex or the urge to spit it out because it does, in fact, start burning or having some sort of tissue damaging impact that will affect all the nerve endings in the mouth. Excuse me. We can also have toxicants that take quite a while to have their mode of action actually initiated. In the small intestine, for example, there's a long residence time, greater than 24 hours typically, or potentially greater than 24 hours. But absorption of toxicants can take place anywhere. And in terms of facilitated absorption, remember that when we eat foods, we have tissues in our gut, our gastrointestinal tract, that are actually optimized for absorption of many chemicals. And so we have the potential for high blood flow, tremendous amount of membrane transport, facilitated transport for nutrients. All of these systems can enable toxicosis in terms of a digestive system route. There was one time in the course I used to give up a slide, and you can probably find this if you search around, of a depressed, clinically depressed individual that tried to commit suicide by drinking a cocktail of whiskey and Drano. This was a very disastrous impact in terms of the caustic. I actually burned this unfortunate individual's digestive system all the way down to the small intestine. And the individual did survive with first aid and with hospitalization, but no longer had a digestive route. And what they had to do to repair this unfortunate individual was actually take his small intestine, put it outside the rib cage, but still under the skin, and connect it with his esophagus so that he could still eat and absorb nutrients, although because he had a very, very short digestive system, no longer had the ability to digest the way he needed to, and so had about a 10-minute, 20-minute residence time of food. And so this is, if nothing, an example of what happens with highly reactive materials. I often talk to chemistry students that happen to touch some base solutions, and the Drano or Lye solution is a base solution. If you've ever been in a laboratory and you've touched that material, you'll notice that it feels soapy on your hands. It feels soapy because it's actually turning the fats in your skin into soap, and it's digesting or dissolving some of your skin, your epithelial cells. The GI tract is complex but simple at the same time. We have, in terms of salivary glands that aid in enzymes for digestion, we have the pharynx and the esophagus, essentially a long pipe down to the stomach, where the primary digestive enzymes happen in terms of processes in the initial stages of digestion. This goes to into the cecum, and then into the small intestine, and finally into the rectum for elimination. There's a fairly high vascular flow in the intestinal tract. This flow is for the absorption of nutrients from our foods in terms of life support and the molecules of life. The energy and fat, proteins, digested amino acids are actually transported directly through the portal vein into the liver. The liver can actually then use these as the reactants in biosynthesis, these metabolic reactions to make various proteins, make various life support systems. As well, the liver can also release back into the intestinal tract via the gallbladder, and we'll talk about this in target organ toxicology. The gallbladder does empty or drain bile acids back into the intestinal tract, and it gives us this recirculation we refer to as enterohepatic recirculation. In the resources on the course website, we have another cartoon showing you how enterohepatic recirculation can actually yield a redistribution and re-exposure to toxicants, because once released back into the gastrointestinal tract through the bile ducts, bile transport system, it has the ability to be reabsorbed and re-taken up by the portal vein and transported back to the liver and to the rest of the body. In terms of the digestive system, we have a significant amount of tissue differentiation at each level. We have the mucosa, which is the outside part. This is avascular, simple squamous or columnar epithelium. In some areas, we have these morphological structures, and I'll show you some slides of this, where we have a very high amount of surface area because of these microstructures. They're referred to as villi and microvilli. These little finger-like structures aid in increasing absorption because of increasing surface area. And so again, the morphology of this particular tissue is essentially engineered, if you will, by biology for absorption, and this is absorption of nutrients. Below that, we have the submucosa, where we find blood flow and the lymph system interface. Why would we have a lymph system interface? Primarily for one of the reasons is transport of waste products, but also for transport of immune reactive cells, the lymph system. Remembering that many of the things that we can eat might have some level of potential pathogenic infection potential. The next layer down is the muscularis, which we have movement. This gives us the peristalsis that we have in our digestive system to move solids from the higher levels to the lower levels of our gastrointestinal tract. Anything that shocks the muscles will get us out of peristalsis. And for those of you who have experienced constipation for whatever reason or illness, have experienced the loss of the movement. On the outside of the this particular digestive system is the serosa, or the casing. This casing, many of you have eaten sausage. It's the casing from various animal intestines is used in sausage manufacturing. There are some ethnic soups, for example, that are made out of intestines. Menindo is a Mexican dish, and there's several others. And so you've seen some of these systems and some of these differentiated tissues in terms of your own diet. The way this looks in terms of the small intestine, it's a pipe. The pipe has these layers that we just went through. We have the villi, the mucosa, and underneath it the submucosa and the muscularis, and then the outside casing. You can see that in the villus and the microvilli that appear on here, we have these epithelial cells. They're highly vascularized because we are trying to impact transport of nutrients. We also have lymph vessels in here because we have the potential impact of bacterial perforations, infectious processes because of food that has some degree of infectious microbiology. And we're also managing the microbiology that occurs normally and naturally in our intestines. If we take a look at this from a different point of view, and one of the things I'm going to try to alert you is this is not a medical MedMicro course, but quite often we'll be looking at two-dimensional representations such as this, which in this case is a medical illustration. This is a two-dimensional rendering of three-dimensional subjects. It's always good in terms of histology and histopathology to remember that when we are doing a microscopic view, that we are typically taking a three-dimensional object and looking at it from one particular direction, north, south, east, or west. And our view can change, the direction that we are viewing can change how the structure is represented. And so, for example, in this case of a villi, even though this is a three-dimensional object, we might think about a cucumber. If I were to slice a cucumber on its side, it might have this sort of representation. But if I diced the cucumber across, it would have a circular representation. And so always have that in the back of your mind when you're viewing a histology slide. This is a histology slide. This is microscopic view. It's stained to give some of the substructure of the villi. And you can see, again, a very high amount of surface area in terms of the cells that are presented on there and maximizing the membrane presentation to the intestinal tract, again, to maximize the potential for absorption. Well, finally, let's finish up today talking about absorption, talking about a case study or an incident. This was in California. It is where it actually started. This was in 1985. This is the 4th of July, and we Americans like our watermelon for our 4th of July picnics. In this particular situation, there was individuals that presented to a emergency room with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, profuse sweating, excessive tearing, muscle fasciculations or just vibrations or rapid twitching, and bradycardia or rapid heartbeat. Aldicarb, this is another carbamate insecticide, and it's a potent acetylcholinesterase neurotoxin. It inhibits transmission of neural impulses. It allows for the impulses to essentially not be stopped, and that's why we have these sorts of fasciculations. This particular insecticide is not registered on watermelons, and this is where we get back to these economic poisons and the testing that's required. As it turns out, we know what chemicals can be used on what plants. This is what happened when there is a violative use. This particular violative use happened because the growers noticed that the watermelons would grow bigger with dosing of this particular insecticide. There seemed to be some sort of hormonal interaction with this chemical and the watermelon plants. People that do metabolism of some of these materials note that different types of plants will metabolize or synthesize or sequester pesticides in different ways. Over the next month, about 762 probable or possible cases were reported. The most severe signs and symptoms included various seizures, loss of consciousness, cardiac arrhythmia, hypotension, dehydration, anaphylaxis, like an anaphylactic shock, an immune cascading response. One individual did die of a heart attack. This may have just been brought on by a pre-existing condition coupled with the stress of this particular food poisoning. I'll have various types of case studies such as this one in this course. And what we'll do is actually refer to a publication by the CDC called Mortality and Morbidity Weekly. And these are weekly clinical reports. As I said, in terms of dose response testing, we don't test on humans for toxicants. We do for pharmaceuticals in phase one, phase two, phase three studies. That was a part of your reading in terms of the toxicology tutor from the National Library of Medicine. But we don't do that with toxicants. And so we use these case studies to know and understand the mode of action, what happens in terms of dose response. It allows us to collect from the unfortunate situations of, in this particular case, a food poisoning, or in other cases, a depressed individual trying to commit suicide, the dose response and interactivity. And in this particular case, what happens as these toxicants get absorbed from, in this case, gastrointestinal tract, digestive system. Next time, what we're going to do is talk about storage and distribution, the next step in our sources, pathways, receptors, and controls. What we're going to try to do is take a look at what happens once these toxins have crossed the epithelial barrier via our skin, via our respiratory or digestive system. What happens next in terms of its ability to be distributed around the organism? Until that time, we'll see you. Thanks.